One of the reasons Shauna had chosen that location was it could not be seen from the mountain peak that contained the maser projector. Dave considered at the moment that meant they couldn't see if the Kristang were coming for them.
"Dave, it's above our pay grade," Shauna said over her shoulder as she finished hooking up their handmade surge inducer.
"We get paid?" Dave said with mock surprise.
"You know what she means, Ski."
Jesse wasn't any happier about the delay than Dave was.
Shauna, is there anything we can do now so we can move faster once we get the go order?"
The two Kristang pilots, happy to be exempted from the dirty, rough, and dangerous duty of clearing a path down to the projector, were sitting in the cockpit of their Jaguar monitoring the condition of the all-important stealth and jamming fields. Behind them in the passenger compartment, the side door was open, allowing a breeze to circulate because the dropship's environmental control systems were offline. The pilots were speculating on what sort of poem would be appropriate to commemorate killing 40,000 of their hated enemy. The commando leader would, of course, officially be responsible for composing the poem himself, but he typically welcomed input from his team. To have one's poem selected by the leader was a great honor.
"We stood unseen, shrouded by..." The lead pilot paused in the composition of his poem.
"What is that sound?"
"What sound?"
The other pilot strained to hear. Neither of the pilots had served on Paradise before they arrived with Admiral Kikrondo's battle group, and they were not familiar with the native life on the planet, particularly whatever animals lived in the tropics. With the steady trade winds rustling the dry palm fronds and whistling through the open door, it was difficult to pick out one sound.
"I don't..."
Then he heard it. A whining sound. Faint. Increasing in pitch. It was getting closer. And suddenly it became a screaming roar as the buzzard cleared the ridge and increased power into a dive. The buzzard's autopilot had been programmed to aim for the center of the clearing, aiming at nothing but grass, low-growing shrubs, and scattered rocks according to its stealth-blinded sensors. The Jaguar was parked toward the east side of the clearing, so the nose of the buzzard missed the enemy dropship entirely and buried itself in the rich volcanic soil. The remainder of the buzzard followed its own nose and exploded, tearing the Jaguar apart and causing that dropship's own power cells to explode.
"Whoa!"
Irene exclaimed, pointing to black smoke and a mushroom-like, roiling ball of fire rising into the sky on the mountain peak. The actual crash site was not visible from the beach. It didn't need to be.
"I think you were right, Major. That explosion is from something more than our little buzzard."
As she spoke, another ball of fire rose into the air, twisting in the wind.
"Yep, those are secondaries for sure. We hit something, whatever it was."
"That's what it looks like to me, too. Strebik, Bonsu, that's good work. Sorry about your aircraft. I'll see if I can get you a new one. Let's launch these boats and pick up the others."
Dragging a boat down to the water with one hand, she called Dave on her Z-phone.
"Chaika, get that drill going. When it punches through to the power cells, set it up for a power overload and the four of you pop smoke down to the beach. We'll have the boats waiting for you."
"Done. There, it's set," Shauna announced, looking up from the drill rig's console. She held up her Z-phone. "I can trigger the overload from my Z-phone. Major Perkins has the same capability."
Slapping the cover of the console shut, she reached under, pulled a lever to release the console, and tossed it on the ground.
"Who wants to do it?"
"Do what?" Jesse asked.
"Smash it,"
Shauna explained, hands on her hips, the expression on her face implying a duh she didn't say aloud.
"So if the lizards get here before we trigger the overload, they won't be able to operate the drill. We can't let them screw with the surge inducer."
"Oh." Jesse's face reddened. It was obvious now that he thought about it. He stooped and picked up a large rock.
"As much of a royal pain in the ass this drill rig has been, I'm going to miss it. Feels like a member of the team by now. Y'all stand back."
He heaved the rock overhead with both hands and swung it down to bash the console.
"Dagnabbit!"
The console's casing cracked, but it was still intact. He tried again with the rock, and this time the console broke in two pieces.
"That did it. We are out of here." Shauna, we have a complication, Dave replied. Nert wants to stay here to make sure the power cells overload.
Oh, great, Shauna thought, while mentally kicking herself. She should have anticipated the young Ruhar cadet would not like the idea of running away from the drill rig before he could be certain it had completed its job.
Nert, I understand you want to be absolutely certain the Kristang can't shoot those transport ships, she said softly.
We don't need to be here to do that. I can overload the power cells remotely. She waved her Z-phone.
Nert's chin bobbed up and down in nervous agreement.
What if the Kristang come here and disable the surge inducer before you trigger the overload?
The young man's words sounded stilted and formal, coming through the translator. He had seen the surge inducer device the three humans had cobbled together from the drill's power supply, and he was not confident it would work. The real problem is he did not trust three backward, primitive humans to operate technology. The lives of almost 40,000 Ruhar depended on him.
They could disconnect the power supply from here.
Shauna could see Nert's fear. The expression was clear even on an alien face. The boy almost had tears welling in his eyes.
Nert, we thought of that, remember? Dave and Jesse installed something we humans call a booby trap.
She paused to see if Nert understood whatever the phrase translated to in the common Ruhar language. Recognition dawned on Nert's face, so she continued.
If anyone tampers with the power connection, the surge triggers automatically. Even if the Kristang blow up this whole drill rig somehow, the power surge will be delivered.
Nert's mouth formed a silent O. Without using his Z-phone translator, he spoke.
It goes boom?
Oh, yeah. Dave put his hands together, then flung them apart. Big bada boom! Like this whole island, kid. We need to make like a shepherd and get the flock out of here.
Jesse snorted with laughter.
Nert, he means we need to leave right now.
12 minutes had passed since the buzzard crashed on its suicide run, and Major Perkins had ordered the drill to punch through the final distance into the projector's power cells. By now, it was likely the Kristang had figured out what was going on and were frantically on their way to the drill rig site. Nert still hesitated, so Jesse tried another tactic. Major Perkins would not be pleased if they didn't bring their young Ruhar liaison officer with them.
Cadet, our mission here is complete. Someone needs to report to your command what happened here.
Whether that made sense to Nert or he was simply happy for a reasonable excuse, he nodded vigorously.
We go now?
Nert, even at easy jogging speed, reached the beach before the three humans. He raced the final 100 meters, bounding along the broken terrain, waving his arms and shouting. Major Perkins waved him toward her boat.
Cadet, where are the others?
Behind me!
Nert pointed back along the stream bed. To the annoyance of Perkins, the young Ruhar was not breathing hard. Her three young, fit soldiers stumbled onto the beach 2 minutes later, breathing raggedly, faces red from exertion.
Chaika, you're with me, Perkins ordered.
They launched both boats in the gentle surf and motored out toward the fringing reef. Perkins had been studying the waves breaking over the reef and had planned a path through the reef. Irene's boat, with Derek, Shauna, and Jesse aboard, was almost tipped over by a breaking wave, but she powered over the crest and into the open sea. Both boats went to full power, headed for the west side of the closest island.
"I'm still not getting a signal from outside, ma'am," Dave reported, playing with his Z-phone. "Whatever jamming field the lizards are using, it covers more than that one island. Should we trigger the power surge now?"
Perkins, who was steering the raft, looked ahead. They were approaching the other island, but she wanted to go around the backside and beach the boats there. If a tsunami hit where they were, it could carry the two boats high up to crash into the island's near shore.
"Not yet. I want to get us around this point first."
"Yes, ma'am, I understand that," Dave said with a frown.
"I'm worried that this jamming field could interfere with our Z-phone connection with the drill rig. When you called us there, the signal had a lot of static."
Perkins looked at Dave sharply. Why the hell had he not mentioned that concern earlier?
"Chaika," she let out a breath, annoyed. Is there a way you can tell on that phone the strength of the signal connection to the drill rig?
Dave's eyebrows raised.
I can check on that.
Shit, he mentally kicked himself. I should have thought of that.
There must be a...
There was a bright flash from behind them. Then the mountaintop erupted like the extinct volcano coming back to life. Dave only had enough time to open his mouth in shock before his view of the exploding peak was obscured by a dust cloud, and the entire island rippled. At first, Dave thought the ripple was the ground shaking, until he realized the ripple was in the air. It was a shockwave headed straight for them. Then the whole mountain exploded, sending rock upward and outward.
Shit! Dave shouted, his face white. They must have triggered the booby trap! How the hell did the lizards get there so fast?
Perkins ignored his question, yanking on Dave's top.
Down!
She shouted so her voice could be heard by the other boat, where Irene had already ordered everyone to lay flat in the bottom of the boat. Emily had barely enough time to throw herself prone and cover her ears when the bone-shaking roar swept over them, followed by a prolonged, low, rolling thunder. Perkins was about to raise her head when the shockwave hit, and the boat was flipped over, sending her cartwheeling across the waves. Impact with the water jarred her, and she briefly lost consciousness, coming back to reality laying face up, supported by the Ruhar life vest that had automatically inflated. The vest included a blinking light and emergency locator beacon, and some gizmo that kept ocean predators away. Coughing up seawater, she looked around frantically for the others. Dave floated a mere 20 feet away from her, holding on to Nert, whose eyes were closed. To her other side, Derek waved a hand weakly and gave her a thumbs up on behalf of the others. The boats had flipped over and tumbled in the shockwave, with the closest one now 50 meters away.
Dave, Chaika,
she remembered Decorum a little too late.
How is Nert?
As she shouted, the Ruhar cadet's eyes opened and he nodded his head at Dave.
Good,
Dave whispered, or it seemed to Perkins that he whispered because her hearing was recovering from the shockwave. Dave saw she had trouble hearing, or his own hearing was affected also.
He is good,
he shouted slowly, giving her a thumbs up. Nert blinked, heaved, and coughed up seawater and whatever he had last eaten.
I okay,
he said, embarrassed. Then his eyes grew wide, and he pointed toward where the projector island had been. Most of the island above a dozen feet above the water was gone. Although there was so much smoke, ash, and steam, not much could be seen. What could be seen were huge chunks of the island splashing into the sea, with some rocks flying toward and even beyond Perkins and her team. But what had truly scared Nert was the wave.
No good,
he exclaimed in squeaky English.
No is good. You think?
Dave replied without thinking. Unlike in movies, this tsunami was not a vertical breaking wave. The entire surface of the sea had risen a dozen feet and was rushing toward them with the front boiling foam.
Hang!
Was all Perkins had time to say before she was engulfed. The first part was not as bad as she feared, being like a wave you might body surf at the beach. Then the wall of water hit like a concrete wall. Chapter 9. In one way, the tsunami did Major Perkins and her team a favor. The massive surge of water lifted them high over the jagged coral reef fringing the island they had been headed for. The wave carried them along, sometimes above the water, sometimes being tumbled over and over in the water. Emily recalled keeping her head above the water 3 times, gasping for air. Most of the time it seemed like she was underwater, even with the Ruhar life vest doing its best to keep her upright and above the surface. The tsunami swept over the island and climbed high into the hills, breaking trees along the way. Perkins and her team had the good fortune to be carried over a peninsula that jutted out from the island, separating 2 half-moon-shaped beaches. The second beach encompassed a broad, deep-bottomed bay. Going from shallow water to deep water dissipated part of the tsunami's force. Emily didn't know how long she was in the water or what happened along the way. She was battered by strong waves and scraped against the sandy bottom of the bay and coral and debris and turned around and around so many times she barely knew who she was. What she did know was that after a while,
she felt someone hugging her from behind and an arm around her chest.
Major, it's me, Chaika. I've got you.
She vomited up seawater, choking and gasping. When she could finally speak, she could only manage a strangled,
Dave.
It's me, he whispered in her ear. Or he was shouting and her ears were too full of water to hear properly.
You're okay, everyone made it.
He waved a hand to Shauna, who was helping Derek get to shore. Jesse, Irene, and Nert were already on the debris-choked beach, coughing up seawater. Broken palm trees were scattered across the beach like matchsticks or bobbing in the still sloshing water of the bay.
Everyone, safe?
Yes, we all made it, Dave assured her.
I can move,
Perkins protested, embarrassed.
I can help you, Dave said gently.
Let me try, she said, and as he released his arm, she found her arms and legs still worked, although everything was stiff and sore. She turned to face Dave.
Thank you, she said simply,
regretting that the rank structure prevented her from saying more. Dave grinned, the grin of those surprised and happy to be alive.
No problem, Major. Watch out for that tree.
Side by side, neither of them swimming swiftly, they made their way through the floating debris to the shore. Emily's boots touched the sandy bottom, and as she splashed her way up to the beach in her soaked uniform, she could not help indulging herself. Holding a hand to her lips as if smoking a pipe and striking a dramatic pose, she pointed to the shattered projector island.
I shall not return.
That remark broke everyone into laughter except for Nert, who of course had never heard of Douglas MacArthur. Satisfied for the moment that no one had life-threatening injuries, she moved on to the next issue.
Does anyone still have a Z-phone?
Perkins patted her pockets in dismay. Her Z-phone had been in the left breast pocket of her blouse, a pocket that had been torn away. Only a scrap of the flap remained.
No, I lost mine. Me too.
Irene held up her credit card thin Z-phone, which was now bent at a 45-degree angle.
I didn't know these things could bend.
Or break. Dave held up the two pieces of his shattered Z-phone.
Nert?
Perkins asked hopefully. The Ruhar cadet shook his head. Without Z-phones to translate, he had to use his very limited English.
I not had that, he said with an awkward grin.
Hell, Perkins expressed her dismay.
We have no way to contact the Ruhar?
The emergency locator beacons on our boats will be transmitting, ma'am. Irene said with as much cheer as she could muster.
One of the orange boats could be seen floating upside down just beyond the reef. The important fact was that it was still floating.
The beacons only tell the Ruhar an aircraft went down here, and they already know that. What I'm worried about is the Ruhar thinking there might still be a threat here and saturating this entire area with railgun darts,
Perkins explained in exasperation.
Oh, shit. Irene looked down shamefacedly. I hadn't thought of that. I hope the Ruhar don't think of that.
Does anyone have a serious injury? Perkins asked. Her left knee hurt, causing her to limp. It felt like if she turned it to the right at all, something important would snap. Everyone had cuts, bumps, deep scrapes, bruises, and what Perkins thought were mild sprains. Everyone was bleeding here and there, none of it immediately serious. Derek had the worst injury. His left wrist was hanging at an awkward angle, and he had three broken fingers on that hand.
We'll survive, Perkins concluded.
The Ruhar will either hit us from orbit or send a dropship. Either way, it won't take long.
Hey, Shauna,
Dave said with a cough, pounding his chest to get the seawater out.
Let's overload the power cells, you said.
That was a great idea.
Did you have to blow up the entire freaking island?
Derek complained with a grin.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Shauna's own voice echoed in her head because of the water in her ears. She tilted her head to one side to get the water out, but it only sloshed around. She suspected she would be picking sand out of her hair and other places for days.
Hey, it worked.
Jesse felt the need to defend his sort of girlfriend.
It did. Irene grimaced at her sore shoulder. Next time, let's try for a solution in the sub-megaton range, huh? I'll remember that.
Shauna kept shaking her head, and the water in her ears kept sloshing.
Ah, there's more sand in my clothes than on this beach.
Perkins felt rubbed raw by the sandpaper-like grit between her clothes and skin.
Me too. Jarrett, Strabik, we need to get these clothes off and rinse them out. We don't need more sand getting in cuts.
Rivulets of blood trickling down her cheek and dripping on her neck. At least the blood was flushing sand out of the cuts.
You men, she looked at Derek, Jesse, Dave, and Nert, go around the corner to that other beach. Meet back here in 20.
Jesse, Dave, and Derek waited with Nert, discreetly peering over the pile of broken trees and other debris to see if the three women had finished washing the sand off their skin and were back on the beach. The three men and the alien boy called out before walking from their bay to where the women were standing in the sun trying to get their clothes dry while wearing them.
That is not fair,
Irene pointed at the shirtless men as Derek hung his shirt on a broken tree branch to dry in the steady breeze.
My shirt is so encrusted with salt it itches.
You have a bra on,
Derek almost snapped at her, his broken wrist starting to throb and making him grumpy.
You don't need to wear a shirt for me.
For a second, Irene considered removing her shirt, as she was wearing a jogging bra, and after all, they were on a tropical beach. There was no real difference between wearing a bra and wearing a bikini top. Major Perkins clearly had no intention of letting the men under her command see her walking around in a bra, so Irene sighed.
Maybe later.
Without her asking, Jesse picked up Shauna's boots, which had become half-filled with sand and broken bits of shell.
I'll clean these out for you,
he offered, turning the boots upside down and bashing them together. Sand, shells, seawater, splintered wood, and one wriggling little sea creature spilled out.
Oh!
Nert exclaimed, pointing excitedly.
That is what knocking boots means!
What?
Jesse's face turned red.
It's not,
Shauna hushed him with a waving hand.
Yes, Nert, that is what knocking boots means. Cornpone,
Jesse,
she blushed,
is showing he cares for me by cleaning my boots.
Ah,
the alien boy nodded with sudden understanding. In halting English, he asked,
this is a prelude to mating?
Nert, Jesse spoke quickly to get the Ruhar cadet to shut up.
That is not, maybe.
Shauna said quietly with a wink toward Jesse.
If Jesse keeps his mouth shut.
Nert grinned.
Less talking, more cleaning.
Jesse waded out into the water, plunging Shauna's boots under the water to get the rest of the sand out.
While I'm out here, you'll toss your boots to me and I'll clean them.
More cleaning, less talking. Jesse was going to clean everything in sight if he had to. Captain Rostall clenched his fists tightly to release some of his nervous energy. Outwardly, he was calm, in cool command of his ship and crew. Inwardly, he chafed at further delays in what had been a long and tedious chase of the hidden enemy ship. If left to himself, Rostall would have preferred the Memhertal to go in alone, maser cannons blazing and missiles running hot. That would be eminently satisfying to see an enemy ship panic, drop stealth, and attempt to accelerate away. That would also be giving the enemy a chance to escape, and potentially to end Rostall's promising career. So instead of giving in to emotion and acting rashly, he waited for the tight beam laser signal from the Grether. The Toman had signaled minutes ago that ship was ready. As soon as all three ships, wrapped tightly in stealth fields, indicated they were ready, he would initiate the attack. Behind Rostall, the communications officer spoke.
Captain, signal received from the Grether. She is in position and waiting your order.
Status? Rostall asked, though on his own display he could see status of all vital shipboard systems.
All systems ready, the first officer reported.
Initiate countdown, Rostall ordered without hesitation. Although all three Ruhar ships were in stealth, using only passive sensors, he worried the enemy could detect their transmissions. The ships had crisscrossed the area, with the Hertal continuing to follow the trail of particles left behind by the ghost ship, and the other two ships determining the trail ended ahead of the Hertal. Somewhere out there, somewhere close, was a stealthed enemy ship. It puzzled Rostal and his sensor experts that a Kristang ship that close had not yet been detected, for stealth was not usually a strength of Kristang technology. Rostal had taken a risk in ordering his ship to maneuver away from the particle trail, so the area ahead was between the Hertal and the star. He was hoping his ship's passive sensors could detect a ripple where the enemy's stealth field bent the star's light around the ship. That technique was known to be quite effective against most enemy ships. Had the Kristang developed, or more likely bought or stolen, advanced stealth technology? If so, discovering the characteristics of such a new stealth field would be more important than destroying a single enemy ship that threatened a populated planet. Both ships acknowledged, the first officer reported. Countdown coordinated and running. 4, 3, 2, 1. Activate. The Mem Hertal, hidden and painfully quiet while acting as a passive sensor platform for far too long, came to life as a warship. Simultaneously with the two other ships, the Hertal dropped her stealth field and extended both an active sensor field to pinpoint the enemy's location and a damping field to prevent the enemy from jumping away. Each of the three ships launched a pair of missiles, initially unguided. The missiles were targeted at the area where the enemy ship was most likely hiding. Once each missile's mothership locked in the enemy's exact position with a sensor field, targeting coordinates were passed to the missiles. The missiles changed course and surged forward at maximum acceleration. Only seconds remained in the enemy ship's life.
No response? Captain Rostal asked anxiously.
Despite his strong desire to see the destruction of an enemy ship that had tormented him for months, he hoped the Kristang would see the hopelessness of their situation and surrender. Because the enemy ship had not declared itself at the time of the ceasefire agreement, the ship was not covered by the agreement, and therefore would not be allowed to simply be transported away by the Jarraptha. Rostal could seize and board the enemy ship, learn its secrets, take its crew prisoner to be exchanged for Ruhar prisoners later. Capturing the glory would be more of a triumph than simply destroying that ship.
No, the first officer's voice reflected puzzlement.
The enemy is not reacting in any way, Captain. No change in status, and they haven't dropped their stealth field.
Could their crew be dead? Rostal speculated.
That is unlikely. We know the ship has been maneuvering.
They could tell because the particle trail had curved and swung back and forth while they followed it.
And not randomly. It hasn't been drifting or spinning around by a malfunctioning thruster. Someone has been directing its flight.
Rostal had a terrible thought.
Or something.
Had they been chasing a dead ship directed only by its AI?
Your orders, the first officer glanced at the tactical display.
The first missile was almost on top of the enemy ship. Rostal took a moment to think. The reason they had fired missiles instead of masers is because incoming missiles gave the enemy time to surrender, and because missiles could be recalled. Rostal could order the missiles to self-destruct or simply deactivate.
Let the first missile run. Put the other five into a holding pattern.
The first missile, its seeker being fed targeting data by all three ships, raced in toward the target. When it was 6 seconds from impact, the missile switched on its own active sensors, risking detection and interception by the enemy ship's defensive maser turrets. The missile was prepared to be fired on by maser cannons. If its computer determined the missile would be destroyed, it would explode its shape charge warhead in the direction of the enemy ship. The missile was not intercepted. It had the unusual privilege of impacting the enemy ship directly before exploding.
Detonation confirmed, the first officer reported.
Then he frowned, rechecked the data, and frowned more deeply.
Captain, there was no secondary explosion. The debris field is barely large enough to be a...
He groaned as the truth dawned on him.
A dropship.
We've been following a dropship, Rostal asked, incredulous.
Or something roughly that size, based on the debris.
How? We have been following radioactive particles, hull coating that we know is from the glory. How could...
Rostal knew the answer to his own question.
The crew of the glory must have scraped off a section of their ship's hull coating,
and put the particles into a container along with oxygen, radioactive reactor waste. Then the container sprayed its contents slowly, creating a trail that appeared to be coming from a battle-damaged Kristang frigate. The Hertal and the other two ships had been chasing a decoy. Rostal slammed a fist down on a console and shouted a Ruhar curse word.
Where is the glory?
Satisfied that the Ruhar guardships were following the decoy, the frigate, to seek glory and battle as glorious, had slowly maneuvered to within 27 light-minutes of the planet they knew as Perdassus. Her captain planned that maneuver to monitor Ruhar guardship movements around the planet before the overworked little ship had to make its final two jumps into low orbit to pick up 39 Commandos Jaquar. Those might be the ship's final two jumps ever, in her captain's opinion. Although the Ruhar's strategic defense satellite network around Perdassus had barely begun construction and the battle group was away on a fleet exercise, the Ruhar guardships were on patrol, ever watchful. 27 light minutes, which was the equivalent of a nice, round, lucky number in the Kristang numbering system, was far enough away so the glory would not be in serious danger from the guardships. If the battle group had been in orbit, frigates might have been sent out to investigate the gamma-ray burst of the glory jumping in. Without support from the fleet, the guard ships were not going to be lured away from orbit. Or so the glory's captain hoped. He checked the sensor displays, finding everything at Perdassus was as he expected them to be, or at least they had been that way 27 minutes ago. He checked the clock. There was no point delaying any longer. It would too soon be time to jump into whatever fate had in mind for the ship that had pushed its luck far too many times already. He turned away from the sensor display and resignedly slumped into his command chair.
Program jump drive for Captain,
Second Officer Smondo called out.
There has been an explosion.
In orbit? The captain asked, gripping the arms of his chair. The Special Forces warriors of 39 Commando had timed their rendezvous with the glory precisely to occur just after the Maser projector destroyed the two Ruhar transport ships. An explosion now would throw off all their plans and make it extremely difficult for the glory to pick up the Commandos. But the timing also did not make sense. When the captain checked there moments ago, the two Ruhar transports were still maneuvering to match course and speed with the top of the space elevator, and one of the transports was still behind the planet. Had the Commandos been forced to act early and attack only one transport?
No.
Smondo was puzzled.
On the surface.
The captain leapt out of his chair to stand beside Smondo and check the coordinates of the explosion.
That's a projector sight, he muttered, almost to himself.
What do you think it means, Captain?
I think, the captain answered with a wryly bemused smile, that 39 Commando will be late for the rendezvous.
He looked directly at Smondo.
Very late.
Oh.
Oh,
Smondo said as the implication dawned on him.
That's the projector sight.
He knew the broad outlines on 39 Commando's plan, but not the details.
They blew it up?
That surely could not have been part of the plan.
Or it blew up on them by accident, the captain mused. They were attempting to reactivate an old projector without the proper equipment or training.
Neither of them considered that a third party may have blown up the site, and 39 Commando with it. They certainly never imagined that lowly humans could have been involved.
What should we do now? Smondo asked.
Now?
The captain sat down in his chair again.
We send a distress call to the Ruhar.
Sir?
Smondo, it is unfortunate that our extensive battle damage has, until recently, rendered our communication systems and jump drive inoperable.
The captain shook his head sadly.
That is why Admiral Kikrando thought we had been destroyed, and why we missed being transported back home by the Giraptha. Now that our heroic repair efforts have been successful, we are complying with the ceasefire terms and reporting our presence to the Ruhar.
Smondo caught on quickly.
I regret to report that the battle damage also affected our computer systems, so that no useful data exists about our recent activities.
That is unfortunate indeed, the captain nodded gravely. I commend our technical staff for keeping the ship operational, despite the severe damage to our computer systems.
I will convey your admiration to the technical staff, Smondo bowed, wondering just how big an explosive would be needed to wipe out the ship's computing center.
The technical staff should know that sort of thing. Several minutes later, the second officer was at the chief engineer's duty station.
You want me to blow it up?
The chief engineer asked incredulously.
I know you and your people have worked miracles to keep the computers operating this long, so it would be a shame to...
No. No, sir, I would love to blow up that obsolete piece of junk, the chief engineer said gleefully. I may reward my team by letting them smash it with hammers, he considered, talking mostly to himself. Is there anything else on this decrepit pile of crap that I can blow up or destroy before the Ruhar arrive? That would prevent Fleet from telling me to keep the equipment going somehow.
Just the computer core for now, Smondo cautioned. However, he said with a wide grin, I will ask the captain about other systems. He may wish for you to render the entire structure unsalvageable. This ship's luck should have run out a long time ago.
Major Perkins had just rinsed her feet and pulled her newly cleaned boots back on, before a pair of aircraft flashed overhead, followed by a sonic boom that rattled her teeth. The aircraft, mere dark, streaking dots in the sky, curved around to circle where the projector island had been. Irene helped Perkins stand steady while she pulled her boots on, watching a rapidly approaching dark spot high in the sky. The dot grew into a Ruhar dropship. It slowed and circled the island as the six humans and one Ruhar cadet waved their arms in a manner intended to be friendly. Perkins hoped the sharp imagers of the dropship would see Nert in his battered Ruhar cadet's uniform and determined the little group on the beach was not hostile.
Uh-oh, Irene announced. They're coming in to land.
Why is that an uh-oh? Jesse asked. Irene and Derek glanced at each other.
Because, Irene explained, pointing left and right along the beach. This beach isn't anywhere near big enough for that dropship to land.
To Irene's relief, the dropship's pilot knew that. The big ship hovered over the water, safely offshore, and opened a door. A Ruhar dressed in some sort of slick coveralls was lowered into the water on a thin cable and headed toward shore, propelled by a thing like a short surfboard with a motor.
Now that's a cool toy, Jesse said admiringly.
The new Ruhar reached the shore and removed its helmet, revealing a young, fuzzy-faced woman. Perkins recognized the rank insignia as Klosta, roughly equivalent to a lieutenant. Perkins saluted and her team followed, but the wary Klosta ignored the humans and spoke to Nert. Nert said something and pointed to Perkins, so the Klosta pulled out two devices like small Z-phones and handed one to Perkins. The Klosta spoke into her device.
What happened here?
Emily Perkins took a deep breath.
How much time do you have?
Chapter 10 Deputy Administrator, technically now acting Chief Administrator, Baterna Logelia stood up when Emily Perkins was escorted into the office.
Major Perkins, it is good to see you.
She offered a warm handshake, not being squeamish about touching the strange aliens.
Please, sit.
When Perkins had sat down, Baterna pushed a ceramic cup and a covered pot across the table, along with a small box.
Would you like coffee?
She pronounced the unfamiliar alien word. Tapping the box, she added,
Or chocolate?
Coffee. Perkins's eyes grew wide.
Chocolate?
She had not tasted coffee, and she could not remember back that far. Her last bite of chocolate had been during the mission for Emby, and that had been a small piece of Hershey bar that was long past its sell-by date.
Where did you get this?
She asked with suspicion and guilt.
Suspicion because UNF HQ had long suspected the Ruhar had a secret stash of human food from Earth. Guilt because drinking or eating items from the secret stash would be betraying the entire expeditionary force, trapped as they were over 1,000 light years from Earth.
We made it, Baterna beamed pride. Your word is synthesize, she said carefully. Our scientists analyzed the chemical structure of these foods. They are confident they have created a reasonable approximation of these items.
Perkins poured herself a half cup, thinking that no matter how terrible it tasted, she could swallow half a cup without gagging. She hummed, pleasantly surprised. The coffee was bitter in a pot sat too long in the burner kind of way. Typical coffee in any army office around the USA, or in any gas station convenience store. She smacked her lips quietly. Something about the flavor was slightly off, until she realized the Ruhar had tried to add vanilla to the brew. Maybe the vanilla was there to mask deficiencies in the overall blend.
Administrator, please call me Baterna, Major Perkins. We have known each other some time now, and often not under official circumstances.
I will call you Baterna if you call me Emily, Perkins replied with what she intended as a charming smile.
Yes, Emily.
This is good. Perkins lifted her cup of ersatz coffee. It's not perfect, but everyone's taste is different.
Please, try the chocolate,
Baterna requested, eager to see if her scientists had been successful with that concoction. They had warned her that, while chocolate was a favorite treat of humans, it was a very complex mixture of subtle flavors and mouthfeel. Opening the box, Perkins found 12 small cubes of chocolate, of a light brown color she guessed had been modeled after milk chocolate. She popped one in her mouth and let it melt on her tongue. It was surprisingly good.
Thank you, I...
She popped another in her mouth before she could think about it. It had been a long time since she tasted chocolate.
This is very good just as it is. Please offer my thanks to your scientists.
I will.
The scientists actually work for the fleet. They created this coffee and chocolate as a gift from Admiral Movalu. The Admiral is extremely grateful for your actions at Tavalin Island.
We performed our duty, Perkins said simply.
Please, Emily, do not be so modest. My nephew gave me a full report in person. The actions of your team saved the lives of 40,000 Ruhar. My people, and myself, owe you a great debt. Because of your actions, and the fact that I am now the acting chief administrator.
The former chief had formally resigned and was waiting transfer back home.
The public perception of UNEF has changed. Most people on Gitanu are related to or knew someone on those two transport ships. Most of my people here would be mourning their loss if not for the bravery of your team. Your team is not being disbanded, although there are few projector sites remaining to be reactivated, so we will need to give you a new assignment. I was thinking your team could train with a Ruhar infantry unit to learn our tactics and equipment. You could observe and advise us. And then your team could select and participate in the training of other humans to serve alongside Ruhar security teams. If, that is, you choose to accept.
Yes, Perkins said without hesitation.
Yes, we would be honored. Thank you, Administrator.
You would be serving what I believe your people call dirt side at first, here on Gitanu. Later, depending on circumstances...
She smiled, sure that Perkins would understand.
Some humans might be offered the opportunity to serve as fleet marines aboard a starship. Admiral Movalu and his staff are favorably impressed by the quick thinking and inventiveness of your team. Using a drill to penetrate the power cells of that projector,
she smiled broadly,
was impressive thinking. Our intelligence people are also impressed that you located a stealthed Jacquard dropship.
I got lucky.
Perkins kept that thought to herself.
Thank you. Will, this new public attitude toward humans...
Toward UNEF, Baterna corrected. Not all humans. Not keepers.
I understand,
Perkins nodded. To hell with those sleeper idiots. Will this new perception of UNEF result in us not being relocated to Southern Lemuria? No, Baterna answered sadly. That project has acquired too much momentum. Buildings and roads and water systems were already being constructed to create new settlements for humans. I did ask General Singh, the current UNEF commander, about the issue, and he assured me the more temperate climate of Southern Lemuria is preferable to the jungles your people currently occupy. However, the timetable for the movement has been relaxed, and some of your people can remain in the jungles if they choose to do so. We will also be allowing your people to fly their own transport aircraft and operate cargo ships.
That sounded like a win-win situation to Perkins.
Thank you, Baterna. I do have two additional requests of you, the Burgermeister said with a broad smile. First, my nephew Nert has requested leave from school to remain with your team. Serving as your liaison officer has been good for him. I would like him to continue with you if you approve. Agreed. Nert is a fine young man, and he has been very useful. Your second request? Emily, could you perhaps try to ensure that your team's future activities are not so...
She searched for the correct English word.
Eventful.
Eric Koblenz flinched at the loud clanging sound as the dropship detached from the cradle in the transport ship's docking bay. 3 days after the Jarapha star carriers jumped away from Paradise, they had rendezvoused with a Theranan star carrier, and the keepers had transferred to a Kristang troop transport ship. Kristang soldiers had herded humans into very cramped quarters aboard the transport. Food and even water had been in short supply, and the attitude of the Kristang crew... anything but friendly. Eric was not the only keeper fearing that he had made a huge mistake leaving Paradise. After many jumps and at least one transition through a wormhole, the transport ship had left the star carrier and maneuvered for almost an hour. Then Eric and 300 of his fellow keepers had been roughly shoved into a dropship. Eric was bleeding from where a Kristang had jabbed him with the muzzle of a rifle to hurry him along. Although Eric was squashed in against the hull of the filthy dropship and the air circulation was poor, he at least was next to one of only four tiny windows. As the dropship cleared the transport ship's docking bay, a harsh shaft of intense sunlight shone through the dirty, scuffed window. Eric blinked and shaded his eyes with a hand. When his eyes adjusted, he peered out the window. The dropship fired thrusters and rotated, bringing a planet into view. Eric gasped.
What the hell are we doing here?
You have been listening to Trouble on Paradise, Book 3.5 of Expeditionary Force, produced by Greg Lawrence, Associate Producer Emily Durr. Text copyright 2017 by Craig Allenson. Production copyright 2017 by Podium Publishing. All rights reserved. If you enjoyed this audiobook, let us know. Take a quick moment to rate and review it on Audible so we know we're bringing you audiobooks you'll love.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.